We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
So, Skeet, we're doing things a little different today. We're actually filming ourselves. And so during this podcast, this is the first episode we've recorded ourselves. We started showing our faces a little bit. I'm probably going to forget that a camera's rolling. So if I get to doing something stupid with my face, just remind me that the camera's rolling. What do you think?
Yeah,
about
that? The only problem I have tonight is we picked a guest that's more handsome than both of us, so we're in trouble.
We're waiting for him to show up, though.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we got James Gearing here from Behind the Shield podcast, who I've been talking to you, Ski, a lot about for probably about a year now, year and a half. Great podcast that he did. And we're going to let him talk here in just a second. But one of the things that I was drawn to with his show and with his Instagram account by the same name is the fact that he pushes a lot of positive videos, a lot of positive messages. He's a firefighter by trade. That's his background. And it's all been just, I think, just trying to change that culture, not in a bad way, obviously, in a positive way, and pushing a lot of mental health, physical fitness, and just one of the few accounts on Instagram that when I see a boost or something in a story, I know it's going to be positive or thought provoking. And so then I always like that. And we push a lot of that, and we push a lot of reading and a lot of books and a lot of music. And he's written a book called One More Light: Life, Death, and Humanity Through the Eyes of a Firefighter. And it's on Amazon. It's obviously you can order it from other platforms as well. But I tell everybody, order the book, especially if you don't know anything about firefighters. It's probably going to be twice as good. But amazing guy, amazing. Josh Brolin does the foreword there, and I'll let James talk about that a little bit. Josh Brolin's a little near and dear to our hearts too, just for his background and croc music and the skateboard movie Thrashing, and of course all of his other blockbusters. But James, I'm gonna let you talk for a few minutes because I'm yapping a little too long. But how did it start with you and Josh?
It's an interesting story, actually. I select my guests very organically, and I'm sure it happens with you too. Someone shows up on your radar, whether it's on a documentary or Instagram, and you're like, wow, I need to get this person on. For example, I just wrote to someone watching the Scouts Honor documentary that just came on Netflix. Not saying that the entire scout industry is about that. Of course it's not, but the push to make it safer, I think, is a conversation that, you know, should be heard. So one of the detectives from that I reached out to. So I'd heard of clearly the horrific Prescott fire. We lost 19 firefighters, and I'd wanted to get someone on the show. Unbeknownst to me, when I reached out to Brendan McDonough, who's a survivor, he was the 20th firefighter from that crew, was sent to a different ridgeline to be lookout. So you assign someone just to be there to make sure that nothing's going to kind of burn over too quickly to the crew that's working. And, you know, things changed. His crew all got killed and he was a lone survivor. And so I reached out to him, and he was actually about to do the press junket for the movie Only the Brave. And so it was weird because it was the first time as a firefighter / podcast that I had to join the press junket to get a guest. So it was very, you know, you're going through the production company and all that stuff. And so we had it was a shorter conversation than normal because they've got so many to do. So I have Brendan on, and that kind of sent me down this road of learning a lot more about the story and the film. And Josh portrayed the supervisor of that crew. Now, Amanda, the real man's widow, was someone I had on next, and he had worked with Amanda a lot to get the character right for her husband, Eric Marsh. So that was really how we kind of connected. I told her that I would definitely love to get him on. He watched me from afar for a long time to see, you know, if I was who I said I was. And as you said, with the account, hopefully, you know, after a while, you realize there's some consistency there. And so we did an interview and we became friends, which is amazing. But the really powerful thing, I think, from that story is I had a friend of mine who worked for Orange County Fire. He was a special operations firefighter, JP. And he got this horrendous autoimmune disease that literally, you know, slowly killed him. And right before he passed away, like at the hospice point by this point, his wife wrote to me or contacted me, Rachel, and said, is there any way we can get a screening for JP? He's too sick to go to a movie theater. And so I circled back to this production company that I had to do the press junket through. I think it was Sony. And they actually flew a copy, and this was about to be in the movie. So this was a hard drive of the film from LA to, I think it was Fort Lauderdale, paid someone to drive it all the way up to Orlando. And JP got to watch this film, and he passed away, I think it was like 6 weeks later. So that story, there's so much power. And you asked me to tell a story at the beginning. Well, here's your story now. Yeah. That story meant so much in the end. And Josh is a part of that, and Amanda and Brendan. But that became so personal to my fire family. And JP had actually been a California wildland firefighter. And he'd gone through the kind of juvenile delinquent program, got him into the fire service, and sent him into the career. So yeah, that's kind of the long thing. And then as we created our friendship, Josh is just about to release a book. If you ever see any of his writing, it is incredible. I mean, the wordsmith of that man is, you know, unlike anything I've ever seen. And so when it came to me writing a book, there was a real kind of artist connection. And then I said, would you write the forward? And he said yes. And when Josh Brolin says yes to your forward, you go, all right, beautiful. And then, you know, then I was like, oh shit, because I did the audiobook. He narrated his forward for the audiobook, which mm-hmm. is great, until you realize the squeaky Englishman that wrote the book has to then follow one of Hollywood's best voices. So therein lies the problem.
Yeah, someday you'll have to get him to do the whole book, right?
Exactly. I'll just erase all my stuff.
That's awesome. That's cool. I can't stop just hearing the Goonies music and seeing him on the bike when the training wheels fall off.
Well, I mean, exactly. I've always heard like really good stuff about him, and he was on Toby Morris from H2O's One Life One Chance podcast, and a lot of people were like, that's a big name actor, you know, taking time to talk to a guy with a podcast. And people who've listened to our podcast know that they hear me talk about H2O, or I'll put a post up or something, but just a great band. But then for him to go on the show, talk about his background, talk about going to see bands play when he was young and the whole skateboard scene and just kind of growing up, he's on that episode anyway, he sounded like just a down to earth guy who happens to be just a great actor. You know what I mean? And then knows that he can do a lot of good in the world, which I'm quite sure he's doing a lot behind the scenes that nobody ever sees or is going to hear about, which is fine. You know.
Well, here's the thing that people don't know. In the middle of his acting career, he paused for, I think it was three summers as a volunteer wildland firefighter in Arizona.
Oh.
So he walked the walk. I mean, this was post Goonies, kind of between that and, you know, the... not the resurgence, but when he came on my show, just to underline how much of an amazing human, it was during what they call the Summer of Brolin. So he had the Thanos movie. He was Cable in Deadpool. He had the white-tailed deer. I think it was Sicario, the first one. So all of those came out in the same year that he came on my podcast. So I think he just, you know, and you look at the people that he's got in his life, some of them obviously a fellow, you know, Hollywood royalty, if you want to use that term, but others are people that he's just met along the way, just down to earth, normal people. And that's the thing about Josh is, you know, I'm not starstruck by anyone, because when you work in police and fire, you're surrounded by people that are pretty admirable, you know what I mean? So, 100%. But I am drawn to great humans. Some of them happen to be comedians or actors or ballet dancers or models, but the commonality is they're all good people, and he's definitely one of them.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I'll probably say one of my favorite roles when he was in No Country for Old Men.
And absolutely.
Huge Cormac McCarthy fan as well. Loved the book. The movie was perfect. But I don't want to sit here and talk too much about Josh Brolin. I do want to talk about you and what you've got going on. I mentioned the book. One of the things that I was telling Ski that kind of I'll say it was pretty impressive. I'm not a numbers guy, but you've got over like 5 million downloads on your podcast. And the main reason I bring that up is because of your material is positive. And you're putting guests on, like you said earlier, how you kind of vet them or how you pick them. And I've kind of been saying this, Ski's been saying it for a while. Everyone loves the good story. Everyone loves to know that other human beings are doing positive things out there. And if we all didn't, you wouldn't have over 5 million downloads. You wouldn't have people, you know, tuning into your show, nor would you have so many people interacting with you on Instagram. And I don't know like how we can kind of get that message out more to people that is what people are starving for. Right. They're not starving for the drama anymore. Nobody wants the negativity. Nobody wants to know, false information or a little bit of like, you know, clickbait stuff. Like people want to see real positive things happening.
Ski, you sound like you're going to jump in for a sec.
You just said something that really stuck out to me, and I love how you worded it. And when you're in the first responder world, you are surrounded by people that are just at such an elevated level day in and day out that do so many things heroic. I mean, it's a word to use for sure, especially when you're in, firefighting and law enforcement and EMS and all that. And that stuff happens day in and day out. And you know, people that serve like that are heroic more than once in a shift. You know what I mean? And so you do kind of hold people to a different standard when you're with your comrades at work and you're like, hey, like most people just don't understand. And that's not a puffing our chest out. But like when you've done a job like that and you've been around those people and you've seen the things that happen. And that's what I love about what you do is you're kind of highlighting that for the world to see. And that's what people need to hear, because we can always be negative, right? And we can always shine light on the dark stuff. And that's what people like to do. But everything that you're doing is saying, hey, check out this hero. Check out this guy. Check out this woman, you know, and that's the cool thing.
I truly believe that's what most people want. Yeah. Like BC said, I really, really do. But the problem is, it's the same thing that I talk about with fitness and, you know, and the obesity epidemic and all these things. There's a lot of kind of shaming to people that are, you know, fat, for example, but there's very little discussion on, well, what is the environment? Is this an environment that sets someone up to make healthy choices? Okay, I get it. Mr. Six Pack, wake up at 5 a.m., stare at the sun, get in an ice bath and eat salad and we'll all look like you. But when you go out of your front door and there's nothing but bodegas and liquor stores or nothing but, you know, fields and nothing even, you know, it's an environment that sets you up for success. And I think it's the same with the positivity at the moment is that we're surrounded by so much negativity that you have to really be a stoic lighthouse of upliftingness. I know that's not a real word, but it's made it up. Because you are weathering the storm. You turn on the TV, Fox and CNN, the same shit, screen divided into four assholes arguing with each other. And this is the news. No, it's not news. It's a drug sales, you know, operation. We'll clickbait you in and then we'll sell you drugs in between. Clickbait you in, there's some more drugs.
Nailed it.
And so, and then you have even on the politics side, it's not like, hi, I'm a Republican. This is what I stand for. We're going to do this for the fentanyl crisis. We're going to do this for the obesity crisis. We're going to do this in our schools. It's just, he's an asshole. She's an asshole. Negativity again. So I think this is where a lot of people fall off, is you're not going to see a massive increase into an audience, into the number of people that listen to your podcast, if you just stay on that path. So people lean in like, oh, let's talk about vaccines or whatever. And then they get off the rails and now you've missed it. So I think that it's just staying the course. I really do. And believing that there is good in everyone. And you see a lot of, I've always said this, a lot of those positive videos get watched millions and millions of times, you know, and yes, some of the negative ones do as well, but how deeply did the negative ones touch someone versus the positive ones? So right, I think, you know, you're sowing seeds and they may not germinate for a year, 2 years, 5 years. But the more of us that believe that that is the right way, the more people will slowly start teetering on the side of positivity. And I think we're seeing that. I think we're seeing people sick of the negativity in the politicians. With people now talking about the COVID again, we're like, wait a second, you didn't care about health. Nothing's changed in our schools. The kids are still eating processed shit shipped in by Cisco. The PE is getting cut. You know, there's no pedestrianizer downtowns. Local farmers are still struggling. So you never cared about health. So I think now there's been a real awakening. You know, Dope Sick and the other one that's on Netflix has just come out. People are now really starting to open their eyes. So I think the more of us that stay the course on positivity, on moving the needle on the health and the mental health, that's the framework. That's the backbone. And if we all give up, then what? So
you just touched on so many things. I could talk for 8 hours on what you just touched on. It just gets me so excited because I'm really down the researching like the permaculture farms and just having like the regenerative agriculture movement and just kind of what, and not researching. I mean, like we've been on that for a long time with the healthy eating and stuff, but taking it to the next level where there's like zero dependency on the food supply chain, to where you can just walk out into your yard and you have healthy soil, you have good water because you have a well and it's tested, and the whole nine yards. But I think what I'd love to talk about is, and you touched on it, is how the fire, EMS, law enforcement lifestyle, how these, how everybody that serves it, what they're up against as far as maintaining some type of healthy lifestyle, because you're getting hit from all angles, like the sleep deprivation because of the cycles, the way we eat, the bad habits that we eat, and then there's the emotional side of everything too. So just kind of what you're working on that to combat that, because I'm also very interested in getting into that coaching, mentoring world of finding these younger officers and kind of before they get to that point and just start walking people through like, hey, this career throws a lot at you, but here are steps we can start to put in place to make sure that your cholesterol stays in check, that you can still put your belt on from the academy 10 years later. You know what I mean?
No, I do. And I think the very first thing that you said is the absolute cornerstone, which is sleep. I've watched someone in my last department, the department paid a local kind of sports performer in Orlando like tens of thousands of dollars to come in and give wellness talks. And this was before I got there, and they were still doing it when I got there. And this woman came in, she was very pretty. So she, you know, it was an entertaining class, but she talked about sleep. And she's like, yeah, so you're sleep deprived. And then she walked out. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, we know that, you know. And then there were some other presentations. Like one woman taught us how to make oatmeal and walk the crew around the station twice. And that was their fitness test. And I'm like, this is $40,000. So we ended up taking that money and putting a bunch of firefighters through TSAC and some of the other things and actually, you know, giving them bang for their buck. But when it comes to the American Fire Service specifically, and I'll get to law enforcement as well, the most insane thing, and all of us are responsible, so it's from the firefighter all the way up to the cities and counties, we work on an average, like bare minimum, 56 hours a week. Some might have a 48-hour week, I think I've got that right, which would be a Kelly day. But most of us are 56. That's before you are told at 7:30, you can't go home. You got to work an extra shift. We're understaffed. Now that's an 80-hour week. So understanding sleep and, you know, the neurophysiology of the brain and the impact on the hormones and mental health and the chance of injury. I have literally put this question now because it was sleep deprivation through Kirk Parsley when he was on Barbell Shrug that took me into even creating the podcast, because I realized this was the elephant in the room. When you realize, when you learn not only the chronic but the acute effects of sleep deprivation from, in law enforcement, the guy that makes that gray area mistake. So it's not the one where everyone says, oh, the cop killed a guy when, well, yeah, he had a gun pointed at his face. I would have killed him too. That's a open and shut case. Then you've got the, you know, the horrendous things caught on film that the officer should never have been in uniform in the first place. Then you have the gray area ones, dark, you know, they just had an officer shot the night before, and now a kid's reaching in his glove box for his license or whatever it is, ends up being misinterpreted and he gets shot. where is the conversation on sleep deprivation there? Where is the conversation on how many shifts did he work back to back or she prior to that? So that's the acute. That's the mistakes that we make. That's the intersection wrecks into the minivan. But then the chronic effects, sleep deprivation is attributed to everything from, you know, the mental health addiction through to obesity we were talking about, heart disease, cancer, you name it. We sleep for a reason. We're mammals. When the sun goes down, we get sleepy. We sleep 8 hours, we wake up. So if you're going to ask a firefighter, a dispatcher, a police officer, a doctor, a nurse in the ER to be awake for 8, 12, you know, 24 hours, you have to create enough time of rest and recovery. And I've had people from the sleep medicine world, you know, like I said, the, you know, I don't know why I'm blanking on the name now, but all the brain experts, you know, the strength and conditioning gurus, the back injury gurus, you name it. And every single one of them says, it's not if, it's when. We're either going to break or we're going to die. Yeah. So to me, the first thing, I mean, you can tell a police officer, all right, before you leave your house, get a little Tupperware box and put some celery and some hummus and everything. Mm-hmm. But if they're not sleeping, it's almost irrelevant. I've had a number of coaches like, if you're not sleeping, honestly, the training and nutrition is almost pointless. Mm-hmm. Because the sleep is where you repair. The sleep is where you, the brain takes a bath. So every single expert from all these different realms have all said the same thing. If the first responders aren't given the time to recover per shift, they will get fatter. They will start getting hurt. They will do all these things. And then they say, oh, it's always the guy who get hurt. Yeah, the science behind it. I always took my job very seriously. I had meniscus tears on both knees and a back injury in my career. And it's because I took my job seriously, but I didn't have that time to actually regenerate after the training. But what's the alternative? Don't train, you know? Mm-hmm. So this would be the biggest thing to initiate the wellness conversation. If we're not talking about the true impacts of sleep deprivation, we're missing 90% of the conversation.
Now, let me ask both of you guys a question and I can answer it as well, but getting into the profession and the career, did anybody have these conversations with you?
BC?
No. It was the opposite. It was, and it's part of it is my fault. I did 4 years in high school and hung out with an older crowd. So I was running around a lot with older people, hanging out at shows and going to colleges and parties and stuff. And then in the Army, 4 years of that. So my college, UPS at night, I always went without sleep and I always felt like I was accomplished. So it just kind of, the more things I accomplished, the more I thought, sleep's a little overrated. Then got on patrol and started realizing even just a 12-hour shift will, and I hate saying the word destroy, but it slowly tears down. So I did, I gained the weight. I didn't get the sleep. And it was harder then sometimes to stay as motivated about working out on your time off. Or like you said, even packing meals, you start to get into that routine of just, well, I'm going to go crash and then I'm going to get up and I'm going to rush off to work. But no, nobody, when I was a rookie or even probably the first 10, 12 years, no one was talking about your health. Nobody was talking about exercise except for, you better be fast enough to catch the person in a foot pursuit. That was the main thing. And can you get, you know, hands on with someone and save my life, so to speak? Like coworkers would say that, you know, like don't let me get hurt. Don't be so out of shape that you can't handle business when it's go time. But nobody was into like stretching, yoga, you know, getting sleep, the importance of removing sugar from your diet as much as possible, you know, those sort of things. So no, I think that has changed quite a bit, at least for some departments, especially stuff like James, where you're reaching out and talking to people about it and the conversations that people have. But yeah, for me, your question, Ski, I like to talk, give you a long answer, but yeah, nobody was talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just mirror that. And the thing is, to be fair, it was only when I listened to Kurt Parsley 9 years ago, 8 years ago, and I had a sports background, a sports science background. I had to be an athlete and a coach. And even then I was like, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And coming from the exercise background, not knowing that, I don't fault people then. But that I've been doing my podcast for 7 years now. So now my tolerance is pretty slim because it's like, okay, even if you haven't looked anywhere else, there's 822 episodes of Behind the Shield podcast that are free. I made a library for you, so you've got no excuse now. So that is the thing, is like, I don't, you know, as they people say, we did the best with what we have. I agree. At that time, you know, no one was talking about cancer when I came on the fire service. No one was talking about mental health, but we are now. So now you have the information. If you are not making a change, then shame on you because you got blood on your hands. And that sounds kind of blunt, but it's the truth. If you are a leader and you're not changing things, then the next deaths that happen are your fault.
There's an individual responsibility that has to take place, but then there also has to be the departments have to also step up, right? You need the people to come forward and say, yeah, we just can't work, you know, 5 12-hour shifts in a row because we're short. Because on, you know, night 4.5, when I make that mistake, it's going to change my life. It's going to change the life of other people. And it's going to change a lot of things. Right. And like you touched on that gray area mistake. And that's just one example of it. Kind of like BC was saying, you know, you go through these academies and it's so backwards, you know, if you're a fast runner and you can do more pushups, like this guy's ready to be a firefighter. It's like, that has nothing to do with the job. You know, it's good to be physically fit, but you know, the Red Bulls and the, you know, the like the granola bars and the diet that they think is the good stuff, you know, it's not. And it's just, it comes down to education. That's what it boils down to. And there's just so much I think that needs to be front loaded. I can go on for days.
Yeah. Well, the pushback that I get, sorry, mate, just to interject, is but we can't afford it. Well, just to use your example, one shooting where they realized the officer was at fault, how much does that cost you?
Mm-hmm.
One single incident. That's not the suicides and the medical retirements and the workman's comp claims and the overtime covering officers that are off. One single one. So this is the problem, is that this false economy of just looking good in a budget year has slowly crippled our professions. And having the courage to say, we need to make a change, we need more money up front, but you will thank me in 5 years because we will save money hand over fist. That is a conversation we have. And I truly believe that if you do that and you put the bar back up where it needs to be, and people now research going, well, this is hard to get into, and they've created, you know, time, rest, and recovery, so these officers are starting to thrive now, I think I will test there. So even the recruitment issue, I think the recruitment issue is because people are smart enough to look into our professions and go, wait a second, that's a Freudian slip. on paper, this actually looks shit. 56 hours and then I can't go home. Then I have to work another 24 on my kid's birthday. I don't think I'm going to do this. I'm going to go work at UPS, where I can run around in shorts. You know, so it's obvious.
And I'll push back on the, you know, any first responder that's listening that says they can't afford it. What you say you value and what your time and checkbook show is what you truly value, right? So if you're like a young officer, and like a lot of us used to do on our days off, especially on night shift, what would you do? You get together with your buddies and you go to the bar because you're up at night. How much is that beer tab? How much is that Uber ride, right? So don't tell us you don't have money, you know, if you're not truly pinching pennies and you are living that lifestyle. You can't really make that excuse, right? It just says that I value, you know, the bar scene with my buddies more than I do to buy nutrient dense food, you know. And I, you know, so you kind of got to push back and call BS on that a little bit too.
Because, and that's on the, well, I'll just interrupt you because that's what I like to do. I like to interrupt people.
Yeah.
That's on the individual level, like Shane Ski. James, you're talking about like on the leadership level. And I saw it probably in the last 2 years just from people joining the agency I just retired from. And the first thing a lot of the applicants were saying is that they were looking for departments that had the longest academies because that equated to the best training. Where 20 years ago or 15 years ago, a lot of people were saying, I don't like going to these long police academies. I just want to get the smallest amount of training as I can and just get on the street to get the real experience. But people that are joining now, that's what they want. They want a department or an agency that's going to train them and support their training and then care about their wellness. And you know, departments will do health checks. You'll get your cholesterol checked, your blood sugar, that sort of thing. But it is pretty cool if someone steps into a room and starts talking about intermittent fasting or yoga or certain stretches or just the idea of you've got to kind of take care of your body a little bit more. And I've sat in in-service training classes before, and some I've been like, ah, I could probably do without this. But there was a block I had on fasting, and I'm not telling everybody that's what they got to do. But I started doing that just to realize, one, it was like pushing a pause button on that right hand of mine. It was just shoving like junk food and, you know, soft drinks or whatever at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'm working. That was just a really bad idea. So for me, it worked out listening to what somebody was saying that our department had and helped out quite a bit. I'm glad to see that culture shift is happening. In the departments that are doing it, fire, EMS, dispatchers, I think that's the next profession you're going to see where people really need to be focusing on wellness for the dispatchers. I hope that most dispatchers have access to a therapist. I know the department I can call a therapist. Our department had their own therapist, and that's what we did. Call 24 hours a day, text, whatever we needed to do. If we needed to talk something out, we could do it free of charge, no stigma. A lot of that kind of went away when a lot of us were recommending other people like, hey, go talk to Doc. Just work your stuff out. It'll be all right. So I do like seeing that. And I'm glad to see that, you know, you and a few other people out there are kind of spearheading that. So that's pretty cool. Now, I got a burning question. I'm going to interrupt you again, man.
Yeah, please. I interrupted you first, so go for it.
I didn't get to mention it earlier, and I don't think you and I talked about it when I was on your show, but you have a stunt background? You used to do stunt work or no?
Yeah, well, I still do technically. I just ended the most recent contract, but yeah, I got into it. I wanted to be a firefighter when I was little. Very long story, very short. They told me I was colorblind at a school physical, said you could never be a firefighter. I believed them. Big, big takeaway from modern society is, just because someone wears a white coat doesn't mean they know what they're talking about.
No.
So fast forward a long time, because I'm not the sharpest tool in the box. I have a realization. I can see colors. Had moved to America by that point. Challenged a medical, become a firefighter. So, but before that, I was fumbling around as a lifeguard for a while. And I went to drama school because I'd met a girl, and that was where she was doing the costume and set design. So I auditioned and got in. And I tell you, nothing like a year in drama school to make you realize when you are the world's worst actor, which I was. But they had to do stage combat. And I was a martial artist, and I was just really good at that. And I got the top accolades and all that stuff. So when I was traveling with her, we got to Australia, and Universal Studios was hiring for the brand new park in Japan. So I got hired as a stuntman there. We kind of pretty much parted ways anyway, so the timing was good. And then that was in 2001. Yeah. And then I literally just did the Bourne stunt show in Orlando up until November of last year. So even at 49, I was still flinging myself around.
Dude, okay. Maybe things were a little different where you grew up. When I was a kid, like a little kid, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old, somebody that was 49 years old usually had a beer belly, grunted every time they had to get up out of a chair. You know what I mean? Like it that in itself, when you talk about being 49, still doing stunt work, is pretty impressive. Not to mention just the stunt work in general. I am curious, are there any... or is there any footage of you doing any kind of acting? I really want to see that.
There's some out there somewhere.
Acting. Good. That's all I need. Hey, I'll find it.
We're going to find it. It's going to be up on our page by tomorrow, no doubt.
There was a show on the History Channel called the True Pirates of the Caribbean, I think it was called. Okay. And it was so bad. But it was one of those ones where it's like telling a pirate story and we're reenacting in the background. Yeah. And it was so much fun. Like, one of the guys I did it with was one of the kids TV presenters when I was little, and Nino, and then I go meet this guy, and we're working on this pirate show in California. But I was supposed to be one character. I was just hired in Anaheim Fire Department, so I was on probation. So they're like, "Can you shoot in Puerto Rico?" I'm like, "No, they will kill me. I'll lose my job." So I had to just do this stuff, and it was in Dana Point, I think it was. But so they gave me this wig, and it looked like I was Brian May's ugly stepchild. It was this black curly wig, and I forget the lines. One of them was like, "That would be you then." And even these two lines they gave me, I cringe every time I see me acting because it's so bad. But yeah, there is footage of my one, you know, television acting, and I'm on IMDb as this actor. But
see, but for the short lines, your accent makes up for it. Like, "That will be you then." Like, just sounds cool.
Well, it was funny. There was some Americans, and they were like, they'd be like, "Oh, listen to my accent," and they'd do it, and I was like, "Is that supposed to be Punjabi?" Because
yeah, mine was
bad. It's horrible, right?
Now,
they were so bad. But
did you ever get like hired for a stunt that you really had to consider whether you were going to do it or not because it was so dangerous?
So the stunts that I did, and it's kind of ironic because when you do movie stunts, of course, you know, there are some things that are super dangerous, but usually, like, you know, if it's a motorbike stunt, they're hiring, you know, one of the best motorbike riders out there. You know, if it's a diving stunt, these are people that are experts in that field.
Right.
But I always did the live shows. So I did the Terminator 2 show that was in the theme parks. I did the pirate stunt show that was in California and Orlando. That was by far the most dangerous just because the safety bar was so low. And, it, yeah. You know, like the pyrotechnics, and like one of the guys that played the same role as me fell off the mast and ended up, I mean, he almost died. He broke his back. Whoa. And everything, because we had this high fall and he fell, missed the high fall pad and hit the concrete on, you know, right next to it. So, and you were doing, you know, like sword fights up on the mast, 20 plus feet. But apart from that, specifically there wasn't, but I never had the skill set to really do anything too extreme. I wasn't like an elite skydiver or, you know, right, anything like that. So when you see some of the crazy stunts, the old school stuntmen were literally just like, "I don't know, I'll try it." And then a lot of them got hurt and died. But these days, you know, if you see an amazing stunt, it may well be Travis Pastrana actually doing that stunt. You know what I mean?
Right,
so,
yeah.
So I was the live show. But the live shows are kind of cool because when you do a movie, and I did the World Trade Center movie just as a glorified extra playing a firefighter, but you don't realize how boring and repetitive it actually is. And even there was a TV show, Crossing Jordan, and I played a wildland firefighter extra in that. And there was a stuntman who hadn't been a firefighter, so all the firefighters were laughing at him because he got it all wrong. But anyway, but you know, it's just like action and then 20 seconds and then cut. Whereas when you do a live show, you fuck up, people get to see it. You fall off into the water, people get to see it. Yeah. You know, you get you jabs the sword up someone's ass, that everyone gets to see it. So I like them more because the pressure's on a lot more in a live show than in the movie. Yeah. You know, if you screw it up, they just scrub that and then do it again.
So was the Fall Guy show accurate then? The one from the 80s? Do you remember that?
I do remember it, and I don't remember it clearly, but I will absolutely tell you that I wanted to be a stuntman because of that show. And when I was little, I wanted to be a stuntman, a doctor, a firefighter, or a pirate, and I ended up doing all four. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's badass. I grew up around an older dude. And I say older, he's like a teenager when I was still like a little kid. And I'd stay over at his house sometimes and watch The Fall Guy. And that's all this dude wanted to do. He's like, "I'm going to be a stuntman. I'm going to be a stuntman." So he would do things like he would jump off. Their house had two stories. I lived in a small house. House had two stories. He'd dive off his deck onto like his trampoline and stuff, like practicing these stunts. He's like, whatever, 12 or 13. So, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, I run into my cousin one day and I throw this kid's name out there. He's like, "Dude, last time I saw that guy, he was riding on the hood of a car down like I-40. And I'm like, "Okay, I guess if you can't be a stuntman, why not get into some trouble and just ride the hood of a car?" But when I was a kid, like we thought that was like legit. Like, okay, hey, I want to be a stuntman. You know what I mean? Like, I never knew how you get into that kind of work. Like, how do you, other than this kid who's like jumping a creek with his go-kart, it's like, how do you even get into stunt work?
Well, in the UK, there was actually a thing, I think it was called the Stunt Performers Directory, and you literally had to be, and this was basically to keep as many people out of the stunt world, so the stunt guys, because there wasn't a huge amount of television or TV or movies, so I get it, but you had to be like a black belt in a martial art and a whatever level gymnast and whatever level high diver and a driver and a horse rider. And the I mean, you'd be like 80 by the time you got it. So I remember looking at that going, well, there's no way. But then you move to America and you have some skills, you know, and you just audition, you know, and if you've got the you know, the strength to pass the fitness stuff and you do the fight choreography and yeah, I mean, they're not looking for, you know, James Bond stunt guys. They're looking for people that just, you know, can hold a fight in front of a theme park audience. So it's a good place. And you see a lot of the top stunt people started in the theme park world. So it is it's nice. You know, the barrier to entry is a lot lower and there's a lot more work here. So.
And there's still hope for me, sword fighting on a pirate ship someday.
You never give up your dreams.
Man. And you've got the perfect accent, Ski, for a pirate.
Really?
No, kidding. Okay. I don't either. Trust me. I don't either. Like, look, listen, check this out. When James talks, I'm like, that's like probably the smartest guy I've ever heard talk because of your accent, straight up because of your accent.
When Wait, I talk, I put my glasses on.
When I talk, people are like, that dude right there doesn't know that we wear shoes and a leather belt instead of a piece of rope, you know, to hold his pants up. Like, people just assume like I'm an idiot because of my Southern accent. I'm partial idiot, but no. Ski, hang in there, buddy. I think you'd make a great pirate.
I appreciate the support, guys. Thank you.
So, James, you've been a firefighter, and you said California, right?
Yeah, I worked, started in Hialeah, which is Miami, suburb of Miami. Spent a few years in Anaheim, California, and then moved back to the Orlando area for the last 10.
Is there a huge difference in like the culture, the subculture, whatever, of firefighting on the West Coast versus Florida?
Yes. I would say California was the most competitive. Okay. I always tell people I would like to think I've worked for one of the best fire departments in the world, in the country, and one of the worst. And that's not an East or West Coast thing. That's an individual thing. But focusing on the best one, when I tested for Anaheim, and Hialeah, by the way, was amazing. The entrance into the fire service I had, those guys got absolutely pounded by their city. I mean, they were paid next to nothing. They ran so many calls. And their academy was, I mean, brutal. Absolutely brutal. I mean, it could be a TV show today. But really set the bar so high for my career. So I'll always give that department credit for putting me on the right path. But Anaheim had a standard that they refused to drop. So every year they would hire, you know, whatever, 15 people per class, and 25% of the class would be gone by the end of the year. They just stuck to it. So by attrition. So it was a real crucible. And you imagine that mindset. Now you get in. Now, hopefully you become a good firefighter, you become a good engineer, you become, you know, captain, chief, whatever. I stayed at firefighter because I love that position. But the setting the bar high to me is the secret sauce of having a good department. The last place I worked at, you'd have to dig a trench to put the bar in, and it showed from the other side. And the sad thing is that one protects one of the most famous theme parks in America. So, you know, and then Anaheim did too. Anaheim is Disneyland. So they protected the theme park as well, but they were a city. So they didn't allow a theme park to tell them how the fire department was going to be run. On the East Coast, different story.
I see what you're saying. I always wonder because like, you know, Ski and I will end up, you know, when we're doing different assignments, you cross paths with other agencies or whatever. And especially now we get to talk to people all over the US and all over the world too. But it's always interesting when you start comparing notes and saying like, oh, my department does this, or even better, you get into like, oh, the gangs here do this, you know, or drug dealers do this, you know, or like what like some agencies will focus really, really hard on, like, you got to be the biggest, baddest dude on the block. You know what I mean? And so all everybody ever talks about is who can shoot the 100, you know, in qualification. And you go to another agency and they're like, yeah, if you can shoot a 90 or above, that's good. But hey, do you know how to talk to people? Can you solve a problem? Can you do this? Can you do that? You know? in a department that, like, I guess, like you kind of say, stands alone and kind of has a backbone that says, we're not going to drop the standards because we've given you this great service for decades. And if we, and that's the recipe, is the standards here. If people really want it, they'll come up to this standard, you know, and then it exceed past that.
I think,
but if you start dropping these standards, you're going to get these scrubs in here, and then you can't dig yourself out of that hole, and people are going to get killed.
That's a common misconception amongst so many people, even some people that are in the profession. I was just fortunate enough to work for two awesome police departments, so I don't really know any different. But at a young age, I just assumed that every department operated the way that these departments did, and then you kind of go in the career and you're there longer, and like BC said, you start talking to these other guys and like, wait a second, your department does what, you know? And that's kind of what, you know, you're talking about, James. But the general public, they just see the uniform, the car and the badge or the truck and the gear, and they're like, well, the expectation from the public never changes, you know? And that's the crazy part, is like, we kind of look at some of these other departments and cringe going, you couldn't pay me $500,000 a year to serve there, you know? I just think it's funny how just, again, that information's just not readily available to most people.
Well, I think another conversation that the public don't get is, we're going to cut firefighters or police officers. They're now, the fire station that was by your house is now closed and we turn it into a restaurant. So now it's, you know, 10 miles away instead of 5 miles away or 2 miles away.
100%.
But I don't remember anyone giving out tax rebates. Like, hey, you're getting shittier service now, but here's some of your tax money back.
Right.
Where's that conversation?
Yeah, exactly.
You are exactly right. We have had this conversation with other people about cities that have deficits in their public service, fire, EMS, police. Well, there's money allotted to pay those salaries, yet you've had a deficit in staffing for 10 years, some of them 15.
Mm-hmm.
Just curious where that money goes, because taxes do keep going up. And it's like, hold on, I'm not the smartest guy, right? But I can do simple math. I do my budget. I know what my finances are. And if somehow I'm making a pay raise, yet I'm still asking for more money, that doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? Like that. And that's a whole nother topic. It's nothing like the question that I've got to ask you is, with all this AI stuff that's going on, artificial intelligence, are we getting C-3PO in the future, or are we getting a Terminator? I mean, in general.
I had a lot of people recently, or let's say a few people are like, James, if you don't get ChatGPT in 6 months, you're going to be behind the curve. And so I'm, you know, pretty humble and open to people's input, you know, and I'm like, okay, let me try and move forward. It was around the time where I was realizing, I started 7 years ago, which in, you know, the IT world is like 100 years. So I was kind of revamping stuff I was doing. And now I use AI, for example. I'm barely able to keep up with current ones, but I'm hoping to go back as well. So transcribe every single show that I've done. So if, you know, someone's hearing impaired, they can actually access it. Now, caution, it's not perfect, so some of it may come across as God knows what. I don't proofread them, but hopefully the gist will be there. So that's a good application of AI. But one of the guests was, I told him I'm writing a book at the moment. He's like, well, you can just put into AI and then you can shift it. And I'm like, that is the absolute antithesis of creativity. Is asking an AI program to write a book for me, and then I go and kind of proofread it. And so I'm not worried about AI at all, because I think, just like the internet has been a tool that can either, you know, create or destroy, it's up to the people and how we use it. So having worked in the Terminator 2 show, which is kind of funny because I played T-1000, right. So literally the AI dude.
That's why, you know, I don't
see it. We're anywhere close to that, because it's clunky at best. And, you know, to me, it was like when the internet first came out. Yeah, it was cool. But even back then, I remember going, okay, it's not there yet. Now we could say, okay, we're literally having an interview over hundreds of miles, if not thousands, recording it on, you know, if I had my thing on, it would be transcribing it as well. That's amazing. The internet is definitely where it's super, you know, user-friendly now. But the AI, I hope, becomes a great thing. Like, for example, the video generation, what I'm looking forward to, it would be amazing. I usually make a 2-minute like soundbite of the show to promote. Imagine if what, for example, one of you guys is saying on my show, and I take that piece and like, oh, that sounds brilliant. And they generate a video on what you're saying, like an animation. Mm-hmm. That would be cool as hell. So I'm all about that. But mm-hmm. as far as the worrying about AI, we have people, you know, that don't care there's a fentanyl crisis, don't care that we're still losing hundreds of thousands of cigarettes, alcohol. Mm-hmm. When has the driving test ever been reviewed? We get 40,000 deaths on the road every year. So, and we're worried mm-hmm. about AI. Let's worry about fucking humans first. Then we'll worry about AI.
That's what I'm talking about. And the people that leverage AI to write the books and write the songs and this and that, you're going to know. Because they all sound the same. Nobody speaks that eloquent. Like, I mean, except for James.
That's right.
But if I used it and I was like, hey, listen to this little poem I wrote. No, you didn't write that. You know? So, yeah.
I have to echo that. The exact just corruption of leaders and people who somehow sleep at night when they're supposed to be making decisions and taking care of human beings. And like you said, fentanyl's enough just to show people and expose to people you're being pushed into taking things. You know what I mean? Like, here's a painkiller, take a painkiller. And I know there are people that have to take things because the pain is so severe. I'm not saying don't take them at all. I'm also saying that, and I think I mentioned this before, I have had a surgery and I was prescribed Oxycontin or Codeine or whatever. It was Oxy. And I was not going to take it because of what Brock Bevel went through. And we had him on like our first episode. But that whole idea of a doctor tells you, no, it's fine. Just when the pain sets in, take these. And then you know that people lose their jobs, they get addicted. Obviously now we're just ramping it up with the new substance, and now that's on the street and people are overdosing. And it's, to me, it's like this idea of it's a slippery slope. It's allowing it to be okay, and then when someone gets addicted, then people are like, well, I want to fire that person because they're addicted to Oxy. It's like, well, how'd they first get on it? You know what I mean? Like, there is money to be made, very large companies. And anyway, I could talk for days and days on that. But yes, you're exactly right. People should be waking up as leaders and doing what's right and starting to pay attention to what everybody else has been talking about and been seeing in the street. And the overdoses are real, and the prescription problem is real. And the just a simple give me something to make me happy or dull or you know, take care of my pain, whatever it is. Sometimes I just wish people would push that pause button and say, okay, how else can I deal with this? Or yeah, I was in pain after the surgery, but I also knew it won't be forever, and it's not so debilitating that I have to take this pill, and I'm scared to death to take the pill because I don't want to get addicted to it.
One thing that I came across a few months ago now, I listened to a guy called Sadhguru, who was on Joe Rogan's show. And this comment was almost made in passing, and they didn't kind of follow up on anything, but it really resonated with me. They were talking about something, and Joe was like, yeah, but, you know, apart from the corrupt, you know, capitalist or whatever he said, you know, the corporations. And Sadhguru goes, no, them too. And they were talking about, I think it was pain or something, but it really made me realize, why is it that we struggle to understand these fucking awful politicians or these corporations? And it suddenly made me realize it's the same mental health problem. Only a sociopath, only someone who has a mental illness could be in charge of a tobacco company or, you know, Purdue, the Sackler family. That's the only way. You can't be a normal, empathetic, community-focused human being and be in charge of a corporation that kills tens or hundreds of thousands of people every year. So this is the part of the conversation that we're missing. If you look at that also as a mental illness, this craving for monopoly, this destroying local farms so that you can have all the farms, therein lies the problem too. And until we identify that, we're gonna, you know, keep blame storming, but not actually look at the root cause, which is, you know, they're in pain too. Now, does it excuse anything? No, but if we reframe it, maybe that will take away some of the power of these people and we'll actually be able to refocus. Because, I mean, the answer to the pain crisis is simply there's so much in the movement world that can fix pain, back pain, knee pain, all these things. You know, there are so many solutions that are holistic. And I'm not talking about rubbing crystals on your knee. I'm talking about fixing the imbalances and, you know, stretching and moving and cold plunges and other things that happen to work. But the pill for every ill, this push, this money-hungry society, mental health is behind that too. Because no healthy tribal culture has a dude that has a monopoly over the rest of the Inca tribe, for example. It just doesn't happen.
100%. Yeah, if you want to get into, do either of you ever watch the Down to Earth series on Netflix with Darren Olean and Zac Efron?
I had Darren on twice. Great series.
He's amazing. His book is awesome. I think his story is phenomenal, and just kind of what he stands for and what he advocates for is so spot on. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It's just getting back all the way down to the root of our innate being and just the way that we eat, the way that we go out in the sun without lathering up in sunblock, the way like our body's designed, you know, physiologically and innately to just absorb nature and the sun and good air and good water and all that. So, but the reason I brought that up is it's a good starting point. It's an entertaining show to watch, but you can actually learn a lot on that show just of what it looks like to strip it down back to that lifestyle that you're kind of talking about.
Well, the other thing as well is, and I talk about this on the show all the time, what Down to Earth shows is that every country has an innovation that the rest of the world could use. They have answers to, you know, they have solutions to problems. You know, I think I've talked about this a lot on the show, NHS in America. Oh, you mean socialized medicine? Oh, that's communism. Nope. I'm talking about a system where everyone chips in and you take care of the people that need it at that moment. Mm-hmm. That's it. Kind of similar to, I don't know, Christian values, Buddhist values, Muslim values, et cetera, where you simply take care of each other, that community mentality. But you look at, you know, Iceland and some of the amazing things they had, and obviously some things are unique. If you've got volcanic, you know, lava going underneath, and yes, you can heat homes using that heat, but there were so many innovative things, like the clean water going through Paris. And if we, every country could have the humility to go, wow, you're doing this really well. Like, for example, Sweden, we called you assholes, but actually you did really well in the pandemic. Can you teach us what you did?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's humility, and the rising tide lifts all ships. Finland's education system, Norway's correction system, Portugal's drug policy, the UK's NHS, I mean, all these things. America has some great things that we, you know, should share around the world. If we had the humility to learn from each other, imagine the change that we'd make.
100%. Yeah. Absolutely. So I definitely want to dive into the book. Now, did you always know that you wanted to write a book, or is it something that just came about?
No, it did come about. I mean, ironically, and it's funny because I'm writing a fiction now, the last time I remember anyone telling me that something I wrote was good, I think it was in senior school, which England is from 11 to 16, but it would have been very early on. But we read Of Mice and Men, and they said, imagine there was another chapter after the ending. I want you to write that chapter. And I remember writing it, and I thought it was good. And then, you know, I think the teachers, I got a good grade for it. But that was actually the very last time I had any confidence in writing. And then right around the time I started the podcast, I went on a call, and it wasn't even a bad call. It was just one of the crappy ones at, you know, 2 a.m. We got back, the rest of the crew went to bed. I went to lay down, and I just couldn't sleep. And it was around the time where the suicides were really starting to be more visible to us. There was a chief in Florida, Chief Dangerfield, who took his own life, and he left a Facebook post before he did, which, you know, went viral in our profession. And so I got back up again, went into the office and sat down, and I just created a website for the podcast, and I decided just to write a blog, my very first blog. And I used a quote from a documentary called Burn, which is about the Detroit Fire Service. And there's an engineer there, Dave Parnell, who says, I wish my mind could forget what my eyes have seen. And that phrase just kept banging around my head. So I just wrote this blog piece. Put it, you know, I think I posted it right there and then, 3 a.m, went to bed. And then when I woke up, it had already taken off. And I'm like, oh, shit, okay. So over the series, I mean, literally of 2 or 3 years, I think I wrote a total of 8. So it was never like, oh, I got to make content, ChatGPT, write some shit for me. It was only ever from the heart, you know, when something was really burning in me. So one of them was called How to Kill a Firefighter in 5 Easy Steps. And it was basically what we're doing right now as an instructional booklet to kill your firefighters. And so then fast forward a couple more years, and I did have the idea like, huh, I think now I've been writing a little bit. A book would be kind of cool. I was 4 years deep, I think, into the podcast, 3 or 4. And I'm like, I've accumulated all this knowledge. I've applied a lot of it to my own life. I've learned lessons and brought things in that, you know, weren't part of the podcast. This would be really good to share. So I tried writing and it was just, nah, wasn't the right time. And I had a firefighter who became an amazing welder on the show, and she talked about this one piece and she'd sketched it. But then it sat in her bedside table for like a year. And then one day she woke up and was like, now is the time. And it was kind of like that. It was right before COVID hit. I kind of sat down. I took the blogs that I'd already made. I started expanding on them to make, you know, full chapters for a book. Wrote a bunch more chapters, and that was it. So it was really, for me, it's not like, I know people can sit down and make themselves write. I can't do that. It has to be something that's just about to explode if I don't write it. And if I'm at that point, then I'll write organically. So, and even with the second book now, some, you know, life got in the way for a bit and I hit the pause button and I had to kind of rethink. And then I'm talking to author friends and they're like, yeah, fiction is different. You got to have this subplot and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of be humble, step back, reevaluate, and then get back in again. So, but yeah, I mean, it's amazing though. Cause I look down now, I've got a box of the books next to me. You know, I think a big misnomer is you're going to write a book and all of a sudden it's going to be in all the bookstores and you're going to, you know, be in all the talk shows. If you get an agent and therefore a publisher, maybe. But I think I've had it out for 3 years now, and I think including Audible, maybe 2,000 copies with Josh Brolin's name attached to it. That's the reality of writing. But the thing is, it's not about the money. If you're writing because you want to put something out there that will help people, I think when they, you know, if the second one comes to the point where I want it to, which I actually want to get it into a film or a TV show, then the first one will probably then get more exposure. Then, you know, we'll see. But that was it. Everything I've done, whether it's the blogs, the book, the podcast, is always, it's like you can't not write anymore. You have to write. And that is where I like to write from. Then it's like Jessica Fletcher on crack. You're just tapping away, you know, until the book is done.
Yeah. I had to
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I write fiction, so I have to block out time and then just write. And then I stop and then block out time and keep doing it. But the problem I have is that the characters stay in my head talking and then they do their own thing. I can't outline things necessarily. I don't know how the book is going to go. I don't necessarily know what these characters are going to do. The new characters pop up and I'm like, I have no clue who this person is. Next thing you know, 4 hours, 5 hours later, you're writing and you realize I didn't even know that person was going to get killed or something bad was going to happen or whatever. So it is weird. Like I've written like lesson plans for classes, or I've written things with the idea that down the road, I want people to read it to learn more about how to do proactive police work or how to do gang work and stuff. But I didn't know you were working on fiction, so that's good, dude. We'll talk later about
like
that.
A little 50,000 foot view of what you're doing, or is it top secret?
Don't do it.
Yeah, we can give you the real overview of the nuts and bolts. Am I totally bleached out here? I look like I am.
No, you're good. You're good.
As it gets darker, I think my face is turning into like a like a mime. the story I want to tell, and this, you know, this won't give it away by any means. What I'm so nauseated by is the pigeonholing, and I think BC, we talk about this a lot. The pigeonholing that creates such prejudice, especially towards addiction, homelessness, sex work, even, you know, gang affiliation. And, you know, I mean, look at the net messaging on the war on drugs. You know, this is your brain on drugs, you know, no actual understanding of a human being's journey. and 830 plus interviews now, probably almost 840 in the can. The number of people's early life is arguably more interesting than what they're known at this moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so many people, especially in uniform, have trauma, which is why I think we're drawn to doing what we do. Yeah. So to be able to tell not just a trauma story, but a multi-generational trauma story where you can go back, not just, oh, well, this is what my home life was like, but what was your parents' home life? And then maybe even before that, I have a concept that I'm extremely excited about. I just need to become the writer that can articulate it in a way that is gripping to the reader. And, you know, reading is awesome, but I think if you want to really get to the most amount of people, it has to be on a screen. That's how you get most people's attention.
Yeah.
If you can articulate that to the point where when they walk away, they turn off the TV, they walk out the cinema, whatever it ends up looking like, they actually sit down and have a conversation and they question their own prejudices, that is what I want to write.
That's amazing. I'm so excited to see where this goes. That's awesome. So, I mean, I think the three of us all still have a service heart, and especially for the profession after being in it. What can three guys like us, with our experience and what we've been through, what can we do to give back to the community now in maybe the preventative maintenance side that we were talking about? But, like, what do you think we can do to actually support and serve these first responders and walk with them, walk side by side with them through their careers to make sure that maybe our divorce rates aren't so high, maybe our addictions aren't so high, maybe our suicides aren't so high? What is the answer to that? You know, before we need to see the psychologist, right?
So a few ideas for us specifically, everyone watching this now, watching for the first time. By the way, congratulations on your retirement and your new face. I think the biggest conversation needs to be, and this is kind of answering the problem that the book is talking about, is if you want to change the world, begin at home and start at home. When you are comfortable with what that looks like, walk outside your front door and become a mentor. Now, that might be a mentor program for young men and women that want to enter law enforcement or fire. It may be mentoring people already in the fire service. It may be coaching. It may be, you know, who knows, anything. But I think that's a big part, because what I see a lot is people will do a presentation at a police department, and maybe some of them have got a powerful story, but then they leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it's like the sleep lady. You come in, you say you need sleep, and then you leave. You come in, mental health is real, and then you leave. So the one thing, and BCU, it sounds like you've got a very progressive department. The one thing that I would say is an easy, easy, low-hanging fruit fix for a lot of agencies. And for law enforcement, I think you and I even talked about this. The polygraph is, you know, mandated at a federal level or whatever it is. When you look at the actual efficacy of a polygraph at a recruitment level, it is smoke and mirrors bullshit. It is Harry Houdini just try and get you to admit, you know, with, I mean, every asshole that I did a poly with, and I did, I think, 3 out of 4 fire departments, same fucking certificates on their wall, the same stories about how, let me guess, you captured Al Capone. Am I right? Yeah. Okay. And it's ridiculous. So that's pot of money number one. Then I don't know if it's in the same in police, but we in fire do what's called the, and I always butcher the name, but the Minnesota personality interview test or something like that. Every psychologist, psychiatrist I've asked about that said that was never ever meant to be a standalone test. Definitely not to determine if a first responder candidate is ready for that profession. Mm-hmm. So pot number two. So instead, you do your background checks, you do your fitness tests, you do your written tests. Now you know if this person is a criminal. And even then, there's a whole conversation then about what is a criminal. Someone who's had a couple of blips, do you exclude them from being a police officer or a firefighter? I say not, personally. We need to be a little bit more open-minded. But anyway, so you've done that. You've done the physical, you've done the written. Do they know the job? Have they got the aptitude? And then you just go ahead. But that money that you were wasting on polygraphs and psych tests, and by the way, the human being that I saw in Orange County's psych test needed to be locked away. Like, she couldn't even see her couch with all the papers. I mean, she was a mad cat lady. So, I mean, some of these psych, you know, these people doing the testing are madder
take
than
it under no one.
So, yeah, maybe. So anyway, so you take that money, and when you go into orientation with a department, we're going to get through, you know, we're going to put through PT and DTAC and all everything that you're going to do in law enforcement. Why not also have a counselor that gives those new recruits 6 sessions? Because so many of us have so much that we brought into the profession. We never talk about that in the mental health conversation. Well, it's what you saw at, you know, the Vegas shooting. That's why you're having problems. Well, they were also molested when they were 4. You don't think that might come into it a little bit? So you're giving them a chance to offload trauma that they had before. You're normalizing the mental health conversation, and you're removing any barrier to entry. So when they start struggling or when they need a tune-up, I'm going to Stephen or Sarah. Boom, done. So to me, you want to make a real dent on mental health. Stop bringing in people to give you, you know, a tearful story, because I mean, that's absolutely needed. And that's what, you know, my podcast has loads of, but you can listen to them on my podcast. But, you know, and I'm not taking away public speaking money. I mean, of course, if you want to bring people in, bring them in. But if that's your only solution to bring in, you know, X cop X, and that's it, you know, check the box, then you're missing the point. So my thing is, even with a budget, take the money you're wasting with polys and psych tests, put it into a counselor. That, I think, would make a huge dent. And then obviously look at your shifts and give people more rest and recovery and sleep.
I love it. And it's about changing the culture and changing the conversation right out of the gates.
Absolutely. The front door.
The whole chest pounding tough guy thing. I mean, it's not the 70s and the 80s anymore. So we can't even grow mustaches like that. So we're out.
And the real leaders of those that era are now coming around saying, let me tell you about my mental health story. And that's one of the most endearing things. Is I had a Pearl Harbor Marine on the show who actually wrote a book on PTSD. And it was amazing. And for a man from that generation to talk about his mental health, and he was wounded on Iwo Jima, I mean, just a, you know, real combat hero. That is what we need from that generation, you know, to save the others and disprove this kind of, I don't know if you have this in police, but in fire, these young guys will come on and they'll start growing a mustache and they'll want to hang on to all the gear that sucks in carcinogens, and they'll talk about not wanting to do EMS, just fire. I'm like, dude, you're literally pretending to be a 1960s firefighter that doesn't exist anymore. You know, so that kind of two-dimensional hero worship is how we end up with more dead firefighters or cops.
Yeah. And they store all that equipment in their brand new Tundra.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And take it home to their kids so the kids can play with the carcinogens.
Sorry.
Cold-blooded, Ski. Cold-blooded. Hey, what's that music question you always like to ask? Stupid.
Who is that?
James doesn't even know who that is, man. James, who is that guy?
I don't know. He looks like he's ready to go into battle.
One of the best soundtrack writers of our youth, right there. That's Mr. Kenny Loggins when he was young and handsome.
One of my guests I just had on is like good friends with Kenny Loggins. His
come
name has never come up on the show. Now I hear his name all the time. I think he's stalking me, Kenny Loggins.
Yeah.
I think you need to get Kenny Loggins on the show, James.
I think I might have to now. It's a sign.
Let us know if that happens.
Get Kenny Loggins.
Done. And bring Messina with him. Bring
that's
Messina
what I was about to say.
Yeah.
was the guest.
He's so overlooked, man. What do you think, BC? So, James, we always end the show by talking about music, and we want to honor your time. So, if you got to go, we can end
it. No, we're good. We're good.
Awesome. Yeah. So, we always get the music conversation in there, and BC always puts me on the spot, and I can't think. So, you got to give me a minute here, BC. So, maybe you got to punt to James.
So, basically, James, just the question breaks down to sort of like this. If there's any kind of music that you're listening to right now, it can be old, new, whatever, that you really dig or that you enjoy listening to, or if you're too busy for music now, was there any kind of music or certain bands or musicians or rappers or whatever that you do like talking about, or you do like telling other people, like, hey, check this out?
Firstly, I think if you're too busy for music, you need to make more time. Music is everything. But so is silence, though. It's good to sometimes not have it. But I'm kind of eclectic on my music taste. It all depends on my mood and what I'm doing. Like, I don't play Rage Against the Machine when I'm driving, so I don't get into a fist fight. I love everything from like Passenger, almost like that kind of folky acoustic guitar music. But what I'm excited about, and I think BC, we talked about this before, I love 90s hip hop. Mm-hmm. And this, I've got something in my mouth, hip hop that's happened recently, or rap that's happened recently, the Dirty South, whatever they call it, you know, sounds like you just came out of a stroke. That's not my kind of music. But what's happening, I think, if I'm seeing it right, is that 90s hip hop is actually having a revival. And my son, who's 16, who's got into hip hop now, he's like, Dad, listen to this. And it was like listening to, it wasn't Nas, but that kind of era again. I'm like, I freaking like this.
Yeah.
So that's what I love when I'm working out. I actually love techno. I did not like techno until I was an athlete in college. So all my friends were doing X and going to raves. And I'm like, what's wrong with them? Why are they so tired in the morning? And then went to Japan. I wouldn't do this because I'm a choir boy, but a friend of mine that looks just like me did X for a few times. And then after that, I got into dance music. I'll be honest. It was amazing.
Did you have lights going all the time?
Say like, again?
Did you have like the Kim lights, like those little glow sticks or whatever? Like,
so here's what was funny. It was in Osaka, and we were working doing stunts. So there'd be a few of us, and we were gaijing, basically non-Japanese. And that particular substance, they call the love drug. Like, you know, alcohol makes you crash a car and kill minivans full of kids and stab people in the face. But actually that drug, which is demonized, makes you dance and hug people a lot. So we would get up on the speakers and start dancing. And all these Japanese that don't normally see Westerners are looking at you and they're high. And you're literally just like moving as one with this whole room of dance people. So I got to say that I have no negative experience. Now, the next day, the come down, you know, I only did it a few times and I'm like, okay, this is kind of crap the next day. And that was it. I was done. But that definitely was a unique experience and some of the most fun nights I've ever had, I gotta say. So, so back to the hip hop though, I think from what I see now, if that 90s sound is coming back, because people are so sick now of like just a bunch of vowels, not even words anymore, and you know, WAPs and whatever that is, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think there's like you said, there's a yearning for positivity. I think there's a yearning for better music in hip hop. And I'm really hoping that that's coming round and they're revisiting that sound. The fashion has kind of come full circle from the 80s to the 90s. And now I think hip hop is as well. So I love 90s hip hop. And I'm excited because obviously we play those songs to death for these young artists to start putting out 90s sounding hip hop again. That has got me very excited. So we'll see.
Yeah,
man, this is ironic. So BC and I went to a concert just a couple nights ago. We saw a good hardcore show. It was the Cro-Mags, and I had to drive a 2-hour drive home after the show. And you had mentioned two different things. So when I first left, I actually listened to Rage Against the Machine. I listened to the song "Wake Up" on the 1992 release album. I listened to it 3 times in a row. Because I love the end of the song so much when he just starts screaming, "Wake up." And it was just one of those jams. And I'm like, I got to keep listening to this. And then as soon as that was over, I put on Biggie Smalls Radio for the rest of the ride home. So I got the Rage in there. And then I got that good hip hop, man. And it brought on so many good songs. But what I'm going to push out is something I go to on YouTube a lot because I like watching, you know, listening and watching, but the Shinedown guys, they do the Smith and Myers, the acoustic stuff where Smith just plays, Myers is just on the guitar and Brent Smith's just singing, but their Adele cover, Someone Like You, crushes it. So check out Smith and Myers, check out their covers, specifically the Adele one. You'll be hooked. That's my recommendation.
They're a Jacksonville band, and there's a festival called Welcome to Rockville that was in Jacksonville. Now it's in Daytona, and I don't like it at all. It's in the raceway, and it just everything echoes off it. But Metropolitan Park in Jacksonville was a bunch of different stages. You kind of walk to each one. The river was right there. We used to stay in a hotel, so you get the little river ferry, go to the concert, come back. but Shinedown would play almost every single year. And I got to say, they're softer rock, but I do love that band.
Oh, they're a great band. His vocals, I mean, he sings from the heart. You can't, you don't meet there, you don't hear too many men singing like that. So that's why I dig them.
Speaking of hip hop, when I was little, I used to have a mini, a Mr. Bean mini, and I had the speakers all put in there. And I used to love Snoop and Dre and all that. So you know, here in Corsham, this, you know, like gangster coming around the corner, and there'd be me, this awkward skinny buck teeth kid. Who the fuck is this? Paging me at 5:46 in the morning.
That's so good.
That's just a good image. It also goes to say, like, music's universal too, though, man. I always love, like, watching people who get into music that they're not, like, supposed to be in that category. You know what I mean? Like that. Like,
exactly.
This kid.
Well, I was a farm boy in Corsham, the West Country of England. And it's funny you talk about intelligent. My native accent, my colloquial accent, is the one that Brits laugh at as being stupid farm people. But but I mean, you think about that. Someone, you know, Biggie wrote it from New York, or Wu-Tang wrote it from, was that also New York area, wasn't it? But, Tupac on the West Coast. And there's a kid on a farm in England that relates to it. Now, not so much the Crips and Bloods. For me, it was more the Sheeps and Cows. But the same concept, you know, where, you know, just that uprising and maybe feeling different than other people. So I think music is incredible.
The way you described it, I pictured the intro to Austin Powers when he's driving the little Brit flag Jaguar.
The Shaguar.
The Shaguar. Oh, I love it.
When you were talking about music and accents, we had Danny Boy O'Connor from House of Pain on. And he runs the Outsiders Museum from the movie and book. It's an incredible place he's got out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But a lot of comments were made to me, DMs and text messages after people listened to the episode, because they're like, Dan, I cracked on you because he's out of town, like I was from the punk rock scene in Kentucky. Like almost like calling me out, like, you don't know about that punk rock. Because it is kind of weird to have this accent and have been listening to it since like 1986. But yeah, Ski's right. We went to go see Cro-Mags play. Great show. I don't know all the details, but I heard today they played another show last night, I think it was, and actually three people came into the club, pepper sprayed Harley Flanagan, lead singer of that version of the Cro-Mags, and stabbed him or cut him. That was the initial detail. So I don't know what happened, but we were just talking that night at the show about how crazy it can get years ago. But we kind of thought that a lot of that had gone away because people have kind of grown up a little bit and just you kind of leave people alone. So I don't know all the details. I hate that happened in any kind of violence at a punk rock show, because I'm always on here talking about positivity and that sort of thing. But I've been listening to a band called Duran Jones and the Indications.
I thought you were going to say Duran Duran there.
No. I do remember Duran Duran. Let me back up. Actually, I misspoke. I didn't like Duran Duran when I was a little kid, but I do have to admit they came out with some album like in the mid-90s, I felt like, that was actually really, really good. The few songs I heard. But secretly, I wouldn't tell anybody. But I can't remember the name of the song, but I remember them kind of having this like
something yesterday, and it was almost like a mandolin playing.
It was
a good song.
It was pretty solid, man. I was listening to like Strife and a lot of like hardcore, you know, music. But secretly, I was like, man, that's actually a pretty good song. But yeah, I just getting into Duran Duran when I was a little kid. But Duran Jones and the Indications. So a cop out in California, right outside of Los Angeles, shot me a song one night. It was like, hey, check this out. Because we always talk about like Richie Valens, and this cop grew up in the punk rock scene too. But he put me on that, man. And it is like going into a time warp back into like, I don't know, 61 to 65, maybe 1960. That sound, that soul sound. Incredible. Also, I got a buddy that put me on Tommy Guerrero. So for some people out there, are like Tommy Guerrero, the skater from Bones Brigade, like in the 80s and 90s, because that was the first thing I said, and that's who it is. So he's got a few albums out, and a lot of it's just solo or instrumental music. But, man, you throw that on, and I don't know how else to describe it. Just check it out, Tommy Guerrero. You can kind of mellow out that a little bit. Throw that's on some Cro-Mag if you need to. If you need to step it up a little bit.
Good stuff. James, when you get Kenny Loggins confirmed, man, we got to know for sure. I want a fanboy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was a comedian I just had, Craig Shoemaker, I think. So I'm going to have to ask him now.
That's what I'm talking about. Thank you so much. This was fun. I really enjoyed the conversation. And just thank you for how you show up in this world, man. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, likewise, this was fun, and I'm honored to be on the very first one where, you know, the big reveal happens, so thank you.
Right. Yeah. We appreciate it, James. Thank you, buddy. Disruptor's out.